Hello, you're listening to a spoiler-filled film conversation. Hooray!
If you're gonna fail, fail safe. Wink.
Captures the spirit of the film.
Yeah.
Jovial, humorous.
Oh my God! We're all gonna die! What are we gonna do? Oh wait, it's just a film, we're fine. Oh wait, reality is far more scary than this film was. Shit. And hello, I'm Richard. Welcome to the podcast. I will clear things up after I've introduced my friends. Here for the podcast is Anthony.
Howdy.
And Abby.
Hello.
And Jamie.
Hello.
And this week we're discussing the film Failsafe, which is, about scary. Well, it's about phone calls, mainly. Just
Wow,
long black and white phone calls.
I was not expecting you to sum it up that succinctly then.
Yeah, but for tradition and clarity, Jamie, you should probably give the details of who made Failsafe, when it was made, and your own précis of what's in the film, if you want.
Failsafe is a 1964 Cold War thriller directed by Sidney Lumet, which is apparently the correct pronunciation of his name, based on the 1962 novel of the same name by Eugene Burdick and Harvey Wheeler. It stars Henry Fonda, Dan O'Herlihy, Walter Matthau, Frank Overton, Larry Hagman, Fritz Weaver, and Dom DeLuise. Dom DeLuise and Larry Hagman are really weirdly young in it, but instantly recognisable.
That was the weird thing for me. It took me a second looking at Dom DeLuise's face to realise there was no moustache on it. I was just looking at him going, what's wrong with your
Well,
face?
I recognised him from his little cameo at the end of Blazing Saddles, where he's doing the big musical, when they like collapse through different movie studios in the big brawl. And he says something like, screw you, I'm work. Oh no, he tells off the, I don't remember the character's name, the right-hand man of the villain, who says, screw you, I'm working for Mel Brooks. And then he goes to hit Dom DeLuise and he's, not in the face! So he punches him in the stomach. And just to summarize the plot, American planes are sent to deliver a nuclear attack on Moscow, but it's a mistake due to an electrical malfunction. Can all-out war be averted? It's depressing as fuck as well.
No, mate. It was a whimsical sci-fi at a
Well,
hilarious alternate universe where
it's
presidents can be selfless. It was
oh.
completely unbelievable and nonsense.
I don't know. Henry Fonda was a very 1960s, presidential act. Also, this was before
was
he was
it was a
in Once
1960s
Upon a Time in the World.
presidential what?
The idea of what the president is supposed to be.
Who was the president then? JFK or who were we on then? Or the Americans?
64.
I think JFK was assassinated in 62, I want to say.
Oh, rip.
So whoever was after him.
US. I don't know. I'll have to. I don't know off the top of my head. But it came out almost the same time as Doctor Strangelove.
Yeah, because dealing with a very similar idea, isn't it?
Well, I think they were. There's some weird, convoluted controversy because there was a lawsuit involved, and it was okay. So the novel that Strangelove was based on was called Red Alert, and then Failsafe was so closely resembled Red Alert that Kubrick and the writer of that book filed a copyright infringement. I don't know. That's really. Because this was based on a book too, so I don't know. But they're very different takes on a very similar story. It's all very much a remote view of a very serious global incident. Just that one's funny and in a sort of depressing way, whereas one's just fucking depressing.
In a sort of funny way, I hope. Yeah,
I.
one deliberately darkly comic, the other one not trying to be comedic. It mostly isn't funny. It tries to be gripping. I guess we'll
Wait,
decide
where
if
did
we.
you get comedy out of this?
Yeah.
There's a
It's quite
massive
funny.
phone. It's really like bang, the president's phone,
I love that's
and
a real
then.
phone. Apparently that's something that like explosives experts will use on site.
That's nice. That's good. I guess are they making phone calls in an explosion? That it needs to be that solid?
No, but it's a security measure because it's a phone that because you doubles know when they up get as a plunger, it's taking the tape off, and then the translator has to do the same thing. It's all very, you know, security. No one else can use this. It's in a special room. Like, I've already jumped way ahead. We haven't even done expectations or anything.
We'll come back to it. Well, all I wanted to say is, right, the phone's mad, and also the one bit of comedy in it is while they're sort of the president's waiting for a call back from the Russians in the midst of oh my god, global missile problems and, you know, proper serious end-of-the-world shit's happening. And there's, a bit where, oh, what about today, wasn't it? To his, translator, and he's like, yeah, no, it was rainy earlier, but now it's going to clear up, so...
Yeah, but that's the kind of shit people inevitably will talk about. They're in a room together for hours just waiting for really serious shit to go down.
The president has decided he's willing to murder his wife. And a bunch of thousands and millions of other people, and he's like, let's just keep it banal while we wait for the phone call.
People do though, that's the thing. Yeah. Like, if you've ever been in, like, it's a weird comparison. But
it's funny you say, Jamie, because the last time I was sitting in a room waiting to talk to the chairman of the Soviet Union, like, what?
No, I mean, like, whenever you're sitting around and a relative is really ill, and everybody's waiting to find out, like, what's going on, or they're going in for an operation or something. Everyone's sitting around in silence. And then, inevitably, they'll be like, does anybody want something from the machine?
Or, do you watch Last Night's Pointless? Oh, yeah. It's good. They got right to the end, didn't they?
It's those kind of conversations that come up, and it's a nice observation of, like, even at those highest levels and in that serious a situation, people are still going to do things that people do.
Sure, yeah, I mean, fair point. It wasn't going for funny. I found it funny, but it's because it was a good observation, and, you know,
it's human thing to do. It's very everyday and typical in a very not everyday situation.
I did find Walter Matthau slapping that woman in the car quite funny, but that's a different story.
What the fuck as well? It was such a weird scene. Like, I mean, okay, we'll come back to expectations,
but I think
it's so weird, that
part. Part of, like, Walter Matthau's contract when he signs a film.
I want to slap abroad.
I have to have a ridiculously attractive woman find me attractive at some point, please.
And I have to slap them in the face violently. I'm not into your... He said that she was one of these Johnny-come-latelys to, like, thinking about murdering people. Like, he's a philosophy professory man about
political scientist.
A political scientist, but he sort of gives lectures on war and morality and things and ethics and this and that, and he basically tells this woman who's come to the social event he went to that she fucking thinks this and she thinks that, and he's not one of those girls. Like, I'm not one of those girls who gets off on and he's just, he presumes a lot, then slaps her for being an attractive woman and him projecting this shit onto her. I don't know, it was a very weird scene, and it was kind of funny. What do you think, Abby? Was there any funny bits in it for you?
Walter Matthau's earnestness, every now and again, I was like, am I missing something?
It kind of threw me because I'm, like most of us probably, I only really know Walter Matthau from, like, either The Odd Couple or then later shitty stuff that he did, like freaking Dennis the Menace, where he was Mr. Wilson, or Grumpy Old Men. Like, he's The Odd Couple in particular is fucking great. Like, that's a fantastic film, and he's really good in it. But it's weird seeing him as an 100% serious actor. And kind of aggressive. Like, he's really the closest thing to an antagonist the film has.
Yeah, he's aggressive and right-wing. Yeah,
it was strange. He was good at it as well.
He was the same in... What was that film we did while back?
Taking Pelham 123, he's a serious actor in that. I don't know if that's what you're thinking of.
No, he was, like, playing a con man.
Oh my god, was it Candy? Because we did that. That was terrible. He wasn't in that very much, but it wasn't Candy. A con man.
Yeah, the name of the film was the character's name.
Charlie Varick or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. Charlie Varrick. Yeah.
And that was, like, a similar thing to Jamie. Like, that was the first time I'd seen him do serious, and I really enjoyed it. And, like, and here again, I was really impressed by him. He's a really interesting actor. And he's getting these very interesting parts and playing them very well.
He's kind of compelling to just watch because he's an odd-looking, like, pudgy-faced guy. But at the same time, he does he had a lot of just a lot of presence on screen.
Gravitas, or... Yeah, he's very granddadly. He's likable in a lovable way, but also, you know, he seemingly can turn on the either comedy or the sort of like serious business stuff.
Yeah,
as well.
He can either play your mum's friendly granddad or your dad's scary granddad.
Yeah,
he can do either.
So yeah, let's get the expectations out of the way, because obviously we've obviously launched in. There's plenty of things to talk about, despite there being, you know, mainly just phone calls one after the other. But, like, and big views of radars. That's basically it. I guess, Jamie, you're first, because you picked it. Why did you pick this? And I guess, what were you expecting from it?
I picked this because of something that my wife watched. She watched something called Ladybug, which is an old, similar era Cold War threat film that is I can't remember what it was about. Anyway, it sort of piqued my curiosity about Cold War focused films from this era, which is you know, films right in the thick of it. Like, we all were born and like in the mid 80s, but you know, you don't remember it that well.
It was definitely wrapping up, and we were probably preoccupied with like preschool and stuff.
Transformers and
Abby, you might have had some. You were just nipping in a little bit older. Did you have the Cold War on your mind when you were like four?
No.
But I wanted to look at a few different films that, you know, took that subject on, because it's a difficult thing, I think, for anyone born after the whole thing had ended to understand how frightening that was for people just day to day.
Yeah, and I think the idea of the doomsday clock was talked about a lot. The closest thing we live in now is post 9/11 fear of terrorism.
Yeah, it's more of a there are still fears like that, but it seems to come from a more abstract place. Like, it's various different threats that sort of come and go. Whereas during the Cold War, which was a long time, it was this one very specific us versus them. If shit goes down, everyone is fucked kind of thing.
Yeah, it was more the communist. Communist Russia, or the communist threat of whichever countries, you know, involved.
Yeah, it's very defined.
Yes, it's a political movement. It's not, you know, countries that have plenty of... Well, you know, they're obviously within communist countries. There are people who are absolutely innocent of any of the crimes or perceived crimes of a country. But, you know, now, it's not the blanket, we hate this country. It shouldn't be, anyway.
Yeah, it's not the overall us versus them that it used to be kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's also not the immediate threat of, you know, the fucking end of the world, which it was for a long time then. But it also, to me, is, you know, as someone who is a fucking cultural theory film disgusting nerd, I find it interesting to see what that did to, like, how that's filtered through art and media. And all through the 60s, 70s, and 80s especially, you get tons of shit that approaches the topic in different ways. And then I saw that this was Sidney Lumet, and realized that we, or in one way or another, are becoming like Sidney Lumet fans podcast, because we've done this. We did 12 Angry Men, which I think got universal approval whenever we did it.
Yeah, this is very much the same black and white men very all similar, angrily talking serious
but
business.
We also did Serpico.
Yeah.
Which was him. Didn't you... Or wasn't Murder on the Orient Express a potential one.
Yeah, we didn't do it, but we did discuss doing it, yeah.
Mm. I think The Wiz has come up at some point.
Yes, he did The Wiz, which I didn't realise.
That's weird, isn't it? That's a departure from this one.
But I mean, he did Dog Day Afternoon.
Lots of ones you sit through and sweat and feel intense.
Yeah, lots of ones that I think this is why I've come to, you know, realise now that I'm connecting the dots and realising what films he did, Network as well was him. Yeah. I'm starting to realise that he makes those kind of films that I like. I think I've said it before, films that could be a play.
They're almost they're like what Charlie Brooker is doing with Black Mirror. It's let's play out a scenario we're all secretly worrying about or something.
Yeah, but at the same time, I mean more like the actual presentation of it with a lot of Sidney Lumet's films, especially from this era, is it all comes through conversation and like interaction between characters. And this film's a good example because it's all played out with most of it is played out within like three rooms, all going back and forth to each other, and all the action's happening on that big radar screen. So, but yeah, I picked it because I went, oh, Sidney Lumet, I'm sure he has an interesting take on this, and it's very close to when he did 12 Angry Men. So,
yeah, so lots of things to tickle your interests and dig your teeth into, and on other phrases like that. Abby, were you like geared up for this and excited? Were you getting your thinking cap on and ready to digest Cold War era ethics and morality?
I thought I was. And then, I'd only just got up. I'd barely eaten my breakfust, and I started watching this film, and I was like, I'm not ready.
Well, as we know, a nuclear threat can happen at any time, and 4:30 a.m. is when the ball gets rolling in this film, so you're going to be munching your conflicts when you're, you know, about to be killed by a nuclear strike. So
I don't get up that early.
You're dead then. Happy in bed. That's the way to go. Silently in your sleep.
Fuck.
So Abby, you made the mistake of not being ready for a serious drama.
Yeah, I was unprepared.
To be fair, so was I. I didn't realise quite how dark this was until until it ended, and I went, "Oh fuck!"
I watched it late at night, so I got the flip side where I was a little bit sleepy and like. And then, in fairness, I was like, oh, look, what's this fucking contextual bullshit? Yeah, a bunch of men travelling to a room and they're having dreams about bulls. Who gives a shit? Get to the hard decision-making bit, please. I knew that was coming. But, I don't know. Anthony, I guess, what were you expecting from Fail Safe?
I was a bit ambivalent towards it because it's, you know, a black and white political thriller from the 60s, and it was clocking up almost 2 hours long. I thought there was going to go two ways. It could have been quite the drag, but then I did then see that it was Sidney Lumet and Henry Fonda, and I feel like I had these similar feelings when we come to watching 12 Angry Men.
It's going to be boring.
Yeah. But you kind of know it's not.
Yeah, exactly.
In a certain way. So it's a kind of weird ambivalent feeling. It's like I wasn't looking forward to watching it, but as soon as I did start watching it, I was gripped, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, same. Hmm. Yeah, like you, I had the same feelings. Like, I know this will be fine, but the initial want to start is a bit, oh. But I was also thinking about current political climates and stuff. I was wondering if any of it was to do. I mean, Jamie, you live in America. You're entrenched in Trump land.
Well, I mean, a lot of the stuff in films like this that do a good job of addressing very serious issues. A lot of it is, even though, you know, the political climates will change, who is considered, you know, the bad guy in quotation marks or whatever will change over time. There is a sort of universal structure that works, you know, that very the discussions in the different rooms and stuff, the things that they talk about are sort of like evergreen topics. You know, the whole idea, Walter Matthau's whole thing about, he's fervently for the idea of, you know, a first strike, and then you've got Blackie, General Black, who you know, is very opposed to that idea. And I thought it was interesting that you've got the civilian, and I think he says it at one point, the civilian scientist advocating for war and the military man advocating for peace.
It's like a big, serious episode of The West Wing.
Yes. Mm. But it's the same with 12 Angry Men. Like, it's a, you know, it's a film from 1957 was Angry Men, but it could be any time because it
I would normally agree with you. I think it is one of these both sides of the debate. I mean, it's about what Russia are doing, it's about what America are doing, and it's about what opposing views and opposing ethics.
It's also about that idea of an accident can kick off
actual.
And it actually, this is another reason that I wanted to do this. I think is that the plot is reminded me of. I think there are two major incidents that happened during the Cold War, where an actual war was accidentally averted because I think it was on Russia's side. There was a malfunction with their equipment, and it looked like there was an attack. And the guy who was ordered to retaliate said no. And he was disobeying a direct order, and I think ended up getting punished for it. And it came out that it was because of a mechanical malfunction, and the fact that he, for whatever reason, you know, chickened out and didn't respond, he effectively saved the world.
It's a weird one. This film deals with that right towards the end, particularly. It's like.
But it's also like a, what if nobody could stop it? And that's the thing that I think got me later on, is that, like, even when both sides know it's a fuck-up, there's nothing they can do, because they can't contact the guy who's fucking doing his job in the plane. Like, that's such a terrifying idea.
For me, just by general kind of movie conventions, you just kind of think in the back of your head, oh, well, it's all going to work out by the end, isn't it?
I think that was what hooked me eventually. Once the actual conversation started between the two countries, in my head I was like, well, they're going to find some kind of resolution. And then I realized, like, as the film was drawing to a close, I was properly, like, on the edge of my seat. Like, they've got to fucking do something. And then they don't. And it ends with fucking catastrophe, and it's horrifying.
Yeah, I mean, it is worth exploring some of the things that, some of the failsafes that go wrong in order to allow for the events to pan out as they did. But what I was going to say was, I would normally suggest, oh yeah, this is applicable to any, this kind of discussion, debate, and something can be triggered by something innocently. Even a fucking tweet now can start fucking countries feuding or making peace, depending on who says it and what they say. But so it's not that something can't be triggered by an accident. It's that Henry Fonda is the sort of president you'd want, where he considers things and is, you know, admit in this film ends up being selfless. But, you know, it's men with different political views making sensible, serious decisions or trying their best to deal with a crisis. And you think, but now in the White House, you've got a man who's essentially got dementia. If a nuclear war happens now, it's not because a mistake's happened. It's because the whims of a nutjob who is just can't take criticism. And, you know, like, the disasters of now, or the threat of global Armageddon now, it's not serious people dealing with mistakes. It's just absolute despot idiots.
It's more of a Doctor Strangelove situation.
These days. I'm not saying Trump is going to, like, kill us all. He very well might. But because he needs the world to keep existing. He's not one of these press the button, kill everyone. He's a press the button, get rid of all the minorities I'm not fond of this week. You know, he would definitely not do the same things as Henry Fonda by a long stretch. But that's where, to me, this was almost when, now governments, the amount they argue amongst themselves, they couldn't come to any quick decisions, I don't think. I almost find it, like, you know, it's good that the pressure's on.
It's almost like an idealised version of what, I think actually, probably now that I'm actually saying it out loud, that's why Henry Fonda's character isn't named. He's just the president.
Yeah.
And I think the idea of that is to have it be... I mean, it's obviously never going to be timeless because they put a lot of like technology in it, which is going to date it. But it's the idea that you can potentially apply it to, you know, whoever in your mind. Because they also don't name... Like, they don't go into... They don't name a vice president. They don't say whether he's a Republican president or a Democrat. Like,
it's a neutralized, like, it's not trying to say anything about whether you're Republican, Democrat, communist, Western, capitalist, or whatever.
The idea is it's bigger than all of that.
It's like, about it's about wars, future wars. It's about the us putting, like, you know, in the 60s they weren't as like now. We just go, let the robots and computers handle everything, I don't care. And back then it was like, oh, can we trust computers, they can make mistakes. Now it's like, yeah, they make mistakes, but I literally couldn't give a fuck. Where's my toasted sandwich app, you know?
So yeah. we're gonna teach an AI how to throw slurs out on social media, but I think that's also probably why they cast Henry Fonda, because up until that point, he was very much the good guy kind of thing. Yeah. That's why it was such a shock when he was the villain in Once Upon a Time in the West. And I think the point of casting him and then not naming his character, not going into the politics of the president in a situation like this in the film, it's he's more of the sort of embodiment of the ideal.
Yes, that's true. He's what you'd want a president to be, which is collected. He'd like, this is a response. Like, this is the thing. His president is so in contrast to the Trumpinator. He's calm, collected. He's playing a president that's this, well, it doesn't matter what his political briefs are. In a crisis, he will be calm under pressure. He will do his best, and he'll realise the limitations of himself and the people around him and bear that in mind. He was so... Yes, this is exactly what we want from, like, a government leader who makes this big decision. There was a very much, he's the father of America, and he will make the final decision, and he's taking it seriously, and to the point where he's like, I guess I can nuke my wife and my friends' wives and family and all of New York to stop a global crisis.
Well, that's the thing, though. Even though, like, that's another thing that I thought was very well done in the film, is that even as, you know, he's introduced and the situation begins and he's very much that ideal and he's very calm and he stays calm through most of it, but there are some escalations where he starts to get angry. You know, he shouts at the person he's talking to on the phone out of just desperation. But there is that then, because he was so calm, as he gets more like frustrated with the situation, you start to realize the weight of the decision he makes at the end of the film. And that's also why I was sitting there going, like, surely it's not going to end like that. Like, there's no way. Like, they'll give him some redemption because he comes across as such a, like, a decent person. But, like, no, he did that, and then there will be fallout after that that you'll have to deal with.
Literal and figurative fallout.
Yes.
And yet, it's still the best case scenario happens.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's such a bleak.
You'd hope for the Russians to go, well, you may have attacked Moscow, but go on. Yeah. You said we could nuke you. You don't have to. I'd be like, it's almost. I mean, you'd just evacuate. So the chairman of the Communist Party in Moscow gets his city. Moscow is nuked by accident. That's the end of the film, more or less. And there's an agreement that President Henry Fonda will to show that it was an accident and to make everything fair on the checkerboard, will allow his country, he'll nuke his own, like, he'll nuke New York, like, tit for tat. So
yeah,
that's
the thing. It's not even that he allows them to do it. He has his own forces do it, which is, fuck. And his wife, his family's there.
It's like a proper neutral, that is fair. I mean, he could have picked Philadelphia or somewhere, couldn't he? Moscow for New York, I don't know. But, like, no, like, totally, it's almost ridiculous that he has this plan from early on. It's almost like, can I even accept that an American president would be like, that's the fairest way to make things even? And you'd expect the Russian to be like, God, don't actually nuke them. Come on, don't be... All right, you didn't mean to. You could just pay us a lot of money to fix Moscow and make up for the damages you caused and the people you killed.
That's the other thing as well, is the... You never see the Russians, but the presentation of them is, like, it's even-handed. They're
going through the same things the Americans are. They give, even the little, like, various people are under stress and have been aggressive in the American side. And we're told the Russians have dealt with that too. They also have had people fainting and not dealing with it. Like, they tell us, without showing us, that the Russians have been behaving exactly as the Americans would. So, anyway. Abby, I have a question for you. You're quiet there?
Mm-hmm.
Henry Fonda for president, yes or no? Did you buy him, is what I mean. Like, did you like his relationship with his translator? Did you find him a reasonable filmic president?
I have always found Henry Fonda infuriatingly reasonable.
even in Grapes of Wrath, which I hate because it's so fucking... This is, like, Grapes of Wrath is bleaker because it's just failed dirt farmers dying slowly of poverty. And it's just, oh, come on, Fonda, don't do this to me, buddy. But yeah, anyway, Abby, you're saying.
He has no flaws and you just can't relate to him as a human being. It's like he's an alien. It's just...
I do agree that with Henry Fonda, just as in most of his roles, but I think that is part. I mean, that's the casting choice here. I think is to present that idea of an impossibly reasonable person who is then forced to do something so horrific and because of an accident, because of just like a fuck up.
Yeah, it's so even-handed because it just wants to show us people dealing with inevitability and problems, and putting aside political views. In fairness to the film even says, like, the Americans are partly there. Some of the American technology is to blame for the mistake, but then the Russians have their technology has affected the mistake being picked up. So they're both culpable. It's playing with the idea that at every fail-safe point, something stops the disaster being averted, and that's like the whole gimmick, is we go through quite a layer of problems that could have been stopped if not for the convenient thing that happened, you know?
That, to me, I think that was the thing that I enjoyed the most about the film. When I say enjoyed, it's hard to say.
You're sitting there slapping your lethargic going, yes! They fucked up again! Ah, in your face!
Actually, that was I did like that scene where they're watching the planes, the Russian fighters get shot down on the radar, and they all cheer, and then that one just like, shut the fuck up, what's wrong with you?
Well, help, it's like this, it's not a like football match or whatever, it's like, because the instinct is to cheer your own guys on. And one of the interesting things straight away is, okay, so, you know, contextualizing the film starts off a bunch of people, you know, it's a day at the office for the Pentagon and all the various government places we're at, and then slowly, like, a blip on the radar comes on, it's a UFO, procedure kicks in, it's being dealt with, jet planes are being flown to intercept something, find out what it is, a bit of tension, if this escalates, do we cross into, you know, Russian airspace, yada yada yada, there's all this, and it's like, slowly, the problem becomes that the Americans think there is cause to bomb Moscow.
A piece of the tech fucks up, and when they replace it, it fucks up the communication with one of the planes that then triggers the order.
Bomb the Russians!
And then they, you know, they do all their, like, taking out their top secret papers and stuff.
I love the scene where they all, they you know, they obviously get a coded message and they're all just like pulling folders out from their like torsos.
Yeah, I think you said like this film is just kind of people having phone conversations. Well, that's just half of it. The other half of it is people opening envelopes.
Yeah.
And they hold the cards up with the code on and look at it and go, it is what we think.
I think that's... It's all very, like, thoroughly researched. A lot of that stuff is how it's done, because it's, like, the simplicity of it, but also having to have that confirmation that no one has tampered with.
Yeah, and what's great is encoding everything, and how, like, so obviously various official procedures where that have to be taken seriously in our life, death, nuclear strikes, etc. If you're going to use the special phone, you've got to get out the special piece of paper and go 153. Yep.
Yeah. Well, it's all. It's like, that's the thing.
It anonymizes the facts and is just terror, and then a code that confirms the terror.
But it's on paper as well, because obviously, from what happens in this film, you can't rely on technology at every stage of it. Like, some of it has to be physical, otherwise something might get lost or fucked up.
It's as important as the deal deal boxes. If they're fucked with, everything gets thrown out.
It's the...
You can't trust printers either. What if a piece of paper has been printed wrong? I wouldn't trust a printer. That's technology.
You can't trust printers anyway. They don't ever fucking work.
Exactly.
They work when
or
they
men.
Want to.
That's the thing. Is it's not just computers. Men can't be trusted to put things in envelopes properly. What if they did that wrong?
I like the film does a good job of addressing those, you know, really big weighty themes of, you know, one mistake causing all this and catastrophe and everything. But one of the things I liked about it and that worked for me was all of the small. The small examples of this, the way they build certain characters and then how that plays into minor escalation of things. Like you have, is it Casco? Colonel Casco? Who has the alcoholic parents.
We get a little glimpse into his life when he's picked up by one of the generals and he's just got these poor alcoholic family that he's like living in the basement of a shitty house somewhere, and he feels judged by his superior. And his superior, you know, doesn't really make a thing of it.
But you have that playing into some of his reactions later because of the stress in the back of his mind. You also have General Blackie's family set up at the beginning, and his previous relationship with the president, because they went to college together and stuff, like... that combined with the tour that they're getting, that was the other thing I really liked, was the two guys who are in for the day to see how it's all working. And I like the way that it all sort of escalates to higher levels of emergency, and all the guys are going, "Ah, that's fine, don't worry, this happens sometimes." And then, like, it just keeps getting fucking worse.
What? It's a nice observation about, like, I think in The Dish... is another film where they have stuff that's slightly abnormal, and they're like, yeah, it'll be fine. Like, it's just, it won't be anything special. It's never, in all these films, everyone's like, it'll never, like, be anything special. Like, whenever someone buys a lottery ticket, I have to make a sarcastic remark about them winning. And obviously, one day, they're going to win, and do you know who's not going to get a cut? Fucking me, because I've been Mr. Smug. Oh, you won the lot. Did you win the lottery then? No, didn't win the lottery. So it's just you're never, the bad thing is never going to come. No, it's always boring. I don't even know why we do the job. It's so banal and nothing ever happens.
Like that, I think part of why that's engaging for me is I know what that feeling is like of when something starts to go wrong that's really serious, but you're like, I'll probably be fine, don't worry about it.
I'm on fire, but it'll put itself out.
There's that little feeling in the back of your mind of, oh, shit, fuck, shit. Someone else needs to reassure me that this is okay, because I think it's going to be okay. It's going to be fine. But I need you also to all agree with me that it's going to be fine. Therefore, it is definitely fine. Uh-oh. Yeah. It's just gone up another level. Like, it's that, that escalation, the fact that it's all done with, like, little blips on a big map was... I don't know, it's just the kind of thing I like, because it's all very... It's all about that tension and the interaction between the characters and the way people just kind of go, oh, when something gets fucked up and that reaction escalates with what's happening.
Yeah, and what's weird is the graphs we see are also, you can't tell a lot from it, it's just triangles. It's like an Atari game and they just zoom in and it's just triangles slowly moving, and it's like, there's not a lot to be, not a lot of information to digest, really.
That's a scene that I wanted to point out that kind of summarizes what I'm talking about. It's probably one of my favorite scenes that I was watching, because it was so well done, is they send their own fighter jets after the bombers to shoot them down, which is already presented as a very difficult decision, because of course it is.
You've got a room full of Americans, and they're all... Yeah. In the back of their mind, you could see they're thinking, is it right to send our own boys to kill our own guys? And they're all... And they're going to die as well. It's so harrowing.
But then, like, they're watching... It's that watching of the blips, like the triangles, and all you see of, like, the action is the main... plane that they're going after, and then the fighters, and they all just gradually blip off the map as they run out of fuel and drop into the fucking ocean.
Yeah.
And then the last two of them just go, and the big triangle that's the plane they were after is still going. I was like, fuck, that's such a great
minimal,
like, they've ratcheted
to it as well.
The tension up so much at that point that all you're looking at is these triangle lights.
Yeah. But Abby, I'll ask you a question, you answer it however you want.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find yourself slowly in the blurry morning, find yourself being drawn in? Did you start to fret about the little green, the little black and white triangles? Did you feel compelled, and did you feel a tension pulling you in?
It was more of a sense of, they're actually going to do this, aren't they? They're not going to do it, are they? They fucking are.
Yeah.
They're fucking going to do this.
Yeah, see, that's what I mean, like... And it does that until the end, and then they do, and that's the end. Fuck! It almost wanted me to be like, "No, fuck off! You can't finish the film like that."
Abby, did you care for the sowing the seeds of? We get a little bit of the humanity and the little, tiniest hint of human characters and their investment and why they, and even Walter Matthau and his like supposing of scenarios. Did you have any thoughts on them sewing that into the film? Was it effective, or did you find it weird or anything?
There's one thing I want to bring up, actually, before I forget about it, because I only just remembered it. That guy's wife did not do a good job of proving herself. She didn't say one thing to prove it was her. Oh, she's like, ring, ring. Hey, it's me! It's me, Mike!
I've got some breaking news, guys. Abby has been called to go bomb a significant target and is going to just give us a brief thought on the film, what she thought of it, before she probably gets shot down by a rival podcast. Abby, go. Before your plane crashes into the sea, the film. Any good?
It's fine. But you know how sometimes you get a really good quality pair of socks, but they're like... I'm not saying grey because it's black and white. I've got nothing against black and white. But it's just sort of like, you never want to wear them because they're grey.
Very right. Good quality, very serviceable socks.
Yeah.
Yes.
But you did like it, them, but it's just, oh, grey.
It's not your style.
Yes, not my style. But I do appreciate the quality and there are good things about it. I'm just sort of, I'm not one for a downer. And you can't get much bigger downer than this.
Yeah,
really.
I kind of wish I'd known before I watched it, to be honest.
Okay, so you have to jet off on your mission, which is doomed to fail. Look, listeners, Abby had some technical problems, like the film has technical problems, and we're sending our bombers out to kill her now. And it's just for the best. I love you, Abby. I'm nuking you off the podcast because it's for the greater good. I apologise, you can't chip in. No, it's too late. I don't care. Horrible noise. Her phone, her headset's melted. We know she's gone. Oh, it shouldn't be so fun to kill my lovely friend and partner. Stop giggling from beyond the grave. Goodbye, Abby. Sorry the technical faults mean you're out.
Bye.
Dead people don't get to say goodbye, they just die. Right. So yeah, right. Abby couldn't continue the podcast, but we're going to go on, the three of us. Maybe one of us will be shot down, I don't know. But let's try and pick up from where Abby was trying to. Abby was trying to articulate that the phone call from the wife was a particularly bad attempt for the wife to communicate that she was really who she said she was. Because he was like, oh my god, it's me, help us! She just shouts at him, and it's like, if I was phoning my significant other to convince them to stop their mission, and it was false information, I could do a good job. Like, if I would be like, I'd use information that was clear to me. Like, the Russians couldn't trick my partner. Like, you know,
There are certain things that only two of you are going to know, no matter how good a Russian spy is.
Yeah.
Like, and that's where you start. You have to establish that personal, okay, this is definitely me, because you are going to think this is a trick.
Yeah, what you do...
I know you've got four balls.
Yeah, that's it. The conversation goes thusly. You go, don't hang up on me. I know it's not protocol. You think that the Russians are tricking you. Please stay on the line. In joke, in joke, in joke. See, it is me. Darling, I have literally got the president telling me you've got to stop your mission. It was a malfunction. And then they'd go, God. I think, also, you know, the jet pilot guy would be like, yeah, I thought it was a bit weird, the mission anyway. And now that my wife never phones me at work unless it's important. She's not one of these, the washing machine's broke, darling. I know you're in the middle of patrolling the skies of Moscow. Like, you know, like, come on. She should have fucking solved the problem should have been ended there with the wife on the phone.
Set up fairly early on that they've called his wife in. Hmm. And again, it's kind of just movie conventions. In the back of your mind, you know that's going to be what stops everything in the end. That kind of like that human personal touch.
Her revelation in front of all of those military guys about him being into being pegged by her. It's surely what was weird.
All the way through, it's setting up. It's giving you that little bit of like, oh, don't worry, because this is something that'll sort it out. It's like, oh, don't worry, but this is another plot line which will probably end with it being sorted out. And it's like, oh, but it never does.
That is the one thing it does so well, is to endlessly fuck over the resolve being positive.
But yeah, it keeps giving you solutions and going, nah.
I would have liked it if they'd have gone, like, the president's like, okay, he might believe the president's a communist or been compromised or they got a faker or whatever, because the protocol of the mission is, if the president says, once you've gone past a certain time or location, the mission's on, assume it's the Russians fucking with you, which gives the communists far too much credit to be that clever and, like, to be so incredibly technologically advanced and be able to manipulate it on a whole Darren Brown-like level. But I would have liked the guy to be, oh, okay, does the guy have a wife? No, he's a bachelor. He has no loved ones or people he would take a second opinion of. Can we get his dog on the line? Woof, 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 woof. Sparky, is that you? Woof, 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 woof. The Russians aren't really a threat that we have to stop? Woof. I don't know. You sound like a communist dog pretending to be Sparky. Like, I would have just like, no, he doesn't have a wife. No, he doesn't. He's no help at all. Where's his wife? She's shopping. She can't be brought to the Ford right now. Fuck's sake.
Your dog's been compromised by the communist leader, Dog Karl Barks.
Oh, well done, Jamie. Well done.
That's very good.
Yeah. Despite, like, how many kind of outs that they're given, I'm glad that it never happens, in a way, because it would have felt cheap. Like a kind of a movie get out, which wouldn't work, because really, if this happened in real life, it wouldn't happen.
I'm sorry, Anthony's phone has been melted. That was not the sound of a train passing by his gaff. It was the sound of a nuclear bomb hitting. He's gone. Oh, wait, are you still there, Anthony? Are you still there?
I'm still here.
Oh, it was a train. The podcast continues. Sorry, Anthony, you were saying.
But it's been so tense and so kind of like politically, like real life driven, that a Hollywood kind of get out where, like, saved at the last minute wouldn't have been right.
I was still expecting it, though. Right, yeah, at same. The end, I was expecting it. And I was expecting the film to end with a lesson of, like, ooh, well, that was a close call, but we have to remember to, you know, not rely so much and not be in this constant state of, you know, paranoia about each other. But it was like,
Yeah, exactly. It's the same thing. As soon as like Henry Fonda came on screen as like the president, and like he got into a lift with Riley Hagman or something, I don't know. You just got that feeling of this is the guy who's going to.
Yeah, he'll fix it.
It's good. Everything's going to be fine.
Yeah.
Someone will sacrifice something small and save the day. But in fact, we have to sacrifice quite a lot.
Yeah.
What I think was interesting as well, one of the interesting dramatical points, not fun points, is we have voices of this is... Because essentially, Fonda starts being a communist sympathising... lefty fucking, oh, because what you know, Walter Matthau pitches that, well, now that we're committed by accident to attacking Moscow, if we send all our planes at them, they'll surrender, we'll defeat communism, because the communists are intelligent to know when they're beat, not want to end the world by attacking back, and hope to survive. And then, like, Walter Matthau sees it as basically, so the American flag just washes over all of Russia, and it's like, yay, we beat communism by blowing them up by accident. And I'm not sure even that would pan out, but...
I think his character is supposed to be similar to Henry Kissinger. So the idea is that he fled Nazi Germany to flee persecution, and then in the case of Walter Matthau's character in this... that has become a sort of fervent, you know, absolutely cannot let them, you know, not, like, they have to be the ones to make the first strike kind of thing. Like,
that's yeah, it's there's a sense from. Of good and evil. It, like, you know, we're stupid, lefty, mostly. You know, we're sort of left-leaning, nice, sort of millennial types and things. So we have a different take on the world, I would say, to that generation. That generation is somewhat justified in vilifying communist Russia.
I mean, there's an anger, there's
the history,
his character. And, there's that, like, bitterness and not bitterness, trauma over his history. And I think Blackie is the one who says that to him. He says that he says something like, in your dedication to beating them, you've become
what you say they are.
You've become your enemy, kind of thing.
Yeah, you're merciless and evil, deciding to attack a nation and, you know, unjustifiedly trying to wipe out a political system that you disagree with. You know,
but you fled that same
oppression. Merciless. Yeah. Horrible evil, yeah. So, but yeah. So, whether you know the right and wrong of communism versus capitalism, etc. Not so much that I'm interested in, but the philosophical point. There's an argument pre all this disaster where Walter Matthau's like with a bunch of toffs, hobbing and nobbing or whatever. He's basically with a bunch of academics discussing war, peace, what might happen. Are there like limited wars? And there's a lot of up your own ass talk about it. And one of the things he proposes that he gets a lot of argument about is, would you, like, which is the nuclear arms race debate in a nutshell, which is, we have to have missiles more than we could possibly need in case they launch a missile. And it's that idea of, if someone attacks your country with a nuclear bomb, essentially ending your country or at least, you know, damaging the world in an unbelievably large way and affecting everything, like... do you go, well, you're not having the world either? Would you rather their culture live? Is it better to wipe out everyone and no humanity and culture lives, or the enemy's culture lives and and stuff?
Yeah, and that's the thing. That's what the whole... really, the Cold War was hinged on, was the mutually assured destruction thing. So it was the idea that, like, no one was going to win. Like, if it came down to it, it would just be both sides, because there was no way to win it. And it's that idea that there would be someone like his character who would, you know, be like, well, yeah.
If I can't play with the toys, you can't play with the toys.
Yeah, no one can ever again.
and I don't know if you guys have the same feeling of, like, you know, whether people should have nuclear bombs to stop other, like, it comes down almost to the I gotta have a gun in case someone else has a gun, which is a big thing in American culture, and they've even got, like, special amendments and their special things. I don't pretend to care that much about gun policies in America. I feel like, you know, guns are a bit of a problem for them, but it's not for me to be like, oh, come on, America. I'm not wagging my finger here. But in a nuclear arms, I've got to protect myself way, I think if someone bombs me in my country with a nuclear... If I wouldn't want anyone to press a button and do it back, I'd be like, well, if a nuclear bomb is hit by me, they're really bad people. The Nazis are back, and they've said, Rich, we hate you specifically. We're bombing you. And then, you know, whoever's in government was like, Rich, you're going to die, mate, but do you want us to fucking nuke them back? I'd be like, nah, if you decide to nuke me, I'll die, because better to let the world live. Even jerks inheriting the Earth, to me, the people who I hate most are the jerks who killed me, and yet, well, don't end everyone. I mean, I'm not a, like, tit for tat. Even when it gets down to the most personal level, I'm like, if someone is childish enough and stupid enough to nuclear bomb somewhere, that should be the only nuclear bomb that goes off, and everyone else should try to stop the people who did it, but, you know, you've got to pick up the pieces, not decide there are no pieces. That's how I fall in the debate.
Yeah.
And this film is trying to sort of talk to you about that point. Do you guys feel differently? Do you feel like you would be like, oh, well, fuck those guys then, or...
I don't know.
All right, Henry Fonda, just fucking make a decision and get back to me. I'm frightened to ask Anthony. I'm kind of curious. Anthony, are you a nuke and back guy?
I'd like to think I'm not, but I suppose the whole point of this film is, like, the human nature. It's like, when you're backed into a corner, what are you going to do?
It is your
life.
How
are you going to feel?
It's nice to say in a situation like that, I'm not petty, but it's you and your stuff. It's like, oh, it's my beliefs, culture. It's just, you know, it's a big ask not to nuke back, isn't it?
Mm.
But, okay.
Fundamentally, you are right. Where, what would be the point of nuking back?
It's all a part of Henry Fonda's impossibly perfect presidential figure, where he's just the fairest man ever, despite all the stakes he has in it. But anyway, okay. What else do you guys want to talk about? Anyway, there's lots of bits we've kind of skirted over. Are there any other pertinent points that comes up in the film?
We haven't really talked about the cinematography and the way the whole film looks. We've been dealing more with the content.
Yeah, I was just going to say, not directly, not about the way it looks, but did anyone else notice there's no music?
It's all... It's just the tension is to do with the noises of machines, which is one of the themes. I tell you what I did like. I mean, obviously, it helps the scenes where the Russian translator and the president are talking, and the president's like, oh, you've got to tell me the tone so I can better understand what decisions the chairman's making. And there's a bit of bonding and a bit of, like, well done, buddy, you've manned up as a translator. There's a nice little bit of chemistry there, but they're in such a plain room. It's just desk, megaphone, not a megaphone, a massive phone, and then just two, like, chairs, and then a blank room, like a bunker or whatever the president's been popped into by his aides. Like, in there, deal with all the world's biggest problems. So I thought it was interesting the times it tried to be super minimal, and, you know, they got big rooms with massive computers and stuff as well, but they do have just simple man-phone conversation.
Well, I mean, that's, I think the idea is that's ultimately what it comes down to, is it's just... It all boils down to these two people trying to talk to each other.
Yeah, and the juxtaposition of, we don't get on, but we have to solve this. And we both, like, it presented, you know, both leaders, we both get this. We're going to argue and be like, I don't trust you. And once they get over the, okay, we trust each other, we have different stakes in this, but we intellectually understand the end game and what the problem is. So we're going to have to act quick and instantly try and agree to shut down this problem as best we can, cooperate even though we're enemies, to stop Armageddon by accident. And I think it's effective, the no music thing, because all we get are computer noises, and then at the end where we get like the melting of photo, like bombs hit, we get a blip on the radar, and then the severe sound over a phone line and the implication of bombs.
Because most of the film is conversation between people and background noise, that sound of the phone fucking melting is a really disturbing noise, because it's so loud and grating. And it goes on for what seems so long because it's been mostly quiet, and especially because you have been told what it means as well.
We get the both ambassadors, American ambassador and the Russian ambassador in Moscow and or New York. They're on the phone line and they're basically told, so what will happen if this failsafe and this failsafe doesn't work? You'll melt. We'll know you're dead from the sound of your phone melting. And then you'll be dead because of the sound of your phone melting. And they're like, do you get this? And they're like, it's just like, fuck these guys getting any character. They're just yes men who are going to get melted. Well, just because the president is like, that I'd be a bit like, hang on. I know there's a crisis, but let's not just melt me and all my friends in New York. How about, can you and Russia just agree on something else, please? God. And the Russian ambassador be like, so the Moscow bomb's going to happen more likely, even if you don't agree that New York's going to be nuked.
Yeah.
Moscow's definitely fucked, and I have to stay on this phone and die? But the president, he gets to leave. Can I leave? Like, you know, come on, cut them some slack.
It's the first one is he's talking about how he can hear the engines approach, or he can hear explosions in the distance.
Bombs, yeah.
Yeah.
Awful. It's so, there's so many stomach churning, oh, that would fucking suck royally, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
And just, it hits you one after the other, there's so many of these, it's like, oh, that sucks.
That's what the ending of the film, because you understand what the consequences are and what's going to happen, potentially, and then, you know, does, there's something way more disturbing about those scenes, about the guy being on the phone and stuff, than, like, gore in a horror film. It's a really... It's almost hard to describe the kind of feeling that scene creates.
You're being put into someone's shoes that are mightily uncomfortable, and it's just, oh, how could you? How can I?
That's also why I, again, not like, but think that the very end of the film is so effective, because they don't show an explosion. There's no, you know, big ending.
Russian cloud and burning.
It's just all those little snapshots of people.
We get New York people is what we get.
And then there's all those, like, the sound cuts out. There's the close-ups.
It's quite fast at the end. It's like, you know, and it's like a more... It effectively speeds it up a little bit.
Because that's, for most people, that's what it would be like.
Yeah, well, and so it does have quite a dramatic avoidance of obvious imagery, which is a really cool artistic thing to do.
I mean, you don't need it.
No.
You don't need, and the film doesn't hit you over the head with that kind of stuff.
It would be superfluous.
Yeah.
Because it's not about spectacle, it's about tension.
I will say, though, the drama of those very last shots, like the quick zoom-in shots, was a little bit reduced for me because it's parodied in a Simpsons episode that I've seen a million times.
Yeah.
The one where Sideshow Bob has a nuclear bomb inside a blimp. And he's threatening, like, he wants all TV to be abolished, or he's gonna set it off, and then he pushes a button, and there's, like, they do the same thing, and there's a kid on a swing, there's Maggie plucking petals off a flower and stuff, and I was like, fuck, that's ruined that for me. Like, I say, in terms of how the film looks, I also noticed that Lumet does the same thing using shot composition and positioning to increase the tension that he did with 12 Angry Men. Like, as the film goes on, the shots get closer in on people's faces and the angles get more sort of skewed rather than just being front-facing.
Something, I mean, that's good, I agree. It's good film craft. Something I didn't care is the way the film is bookended with some kind of dream about matadors. So the blackie guy, general, he has a weird... We open up on him 4:30 a.m. New York. He has a dream. He wakes up to his wife, and he as soon as you have it, he has the chat about, oh, don't go to work today, darling. Stay home with us and the kids and have a lovely day. And if he didn't, the world events would be different, and maybe even they'd be living. Or even if they die, they'd have had a nice day instead of destroying yourself and New York. But he has this fucking chat about, oh, a fucking horrible bull dream where, like, there's a bull and a matador and I go all wobbly. And then at the end, where Blackie is the American pilot who's been sent to bomb New York to make sure.
Yeah.
To make sure that, like, it's a bomb his family in New York, to make sure that it's the playing field is even.
Level.
And that the survivors can mutually rebuild together without the nuclear threat continuing. And he has this, he does it, he mans up and does the mental thing of doing it. I don't know how. I mean, I guess. I can't really see it. But he's like, I'll take it full. He does, he takes the full brunt of the responsibility and then he fucking stabs himself with a special pen to kill himself. I don't know. He injects himself with something to kill himself after he does it.
Yeah, some kind of poison or something.
And then before that, he sort of deliriously talks about bulls and matadors again. And I think, whatever metaphor you're fucking reaching for here about the matador and the bull, I'm fucking not getting it because it's just, you don't need that. The rest of the film's quite strong. Whatever you're trying to say is too twatty, I think. That's a bit wanky, that metaphor, or whatever they're going for.
That is I normally argue with you about stuff that is a bit more abstract and strange, but
It's just a dream epiphany that's like coming to fruition in his own
perspective. It's a weird, like, it's like an almost supernatural premonition in a film that doesn't have anything like that in it. I don't know if it was in the book and Demet just kept it, but like, it is the thing for me that does take away a little bit, other than the bleakness of it being why I would rather watch 12 Angry Men again.
Yeah.
12 Angry Men does stick completely to that everything is happening in this
like a tone,
real setting. Yeah. Whereas the dream at the beginning and the end just seems a little bit, it's I get it, but it's a bit off for the rest of the film. Like, it wasn't
for me, like, that's all.
And usually that kind of stuff is for me, but like, I was like, well, you didn't really need that. And I almost feel like the credits happening in silence rather than the crowd cheering the matador or whatever.
Oh, is that what that was? I thought it was like, I wasn't sure, because they have like a weird noise over the credits. I thought it was like the repercussion noises, the sort of insanity of like whatever was happening after nuclear strikes.
No, it's the cheering crowd of the sounds from the opening dream.
Yeah. Anthony, what do you reckon? Is this like a metaphor, symbolism too far? Or?
I personally didn't find it too distracting, but I can see what you mean. I think maybe it's a little too on the nose and a little too unsubtle a metaphor, if you know what I mean.
It's a bit too artistically inclined for a film that is pretty grounded, really.
Yeah. And we've had one jet scene that's excruciating, where like we cut to the American jet pilots who are doing their job. The mistake has happened, the technical fault has sent them on this mission, and they go ahead with it. And there's a few times you think, oh, come on, you definitely think something's a bit weird. But you're trying to put yourself in that. So you're a soldier, and a soldier follows orders. And if the orders are proved to be correct as far as you know, you keep doing it. To the point where you go, jet pilots who have nuclear missiles, they have to be willing to murder countries because they're government has said so, and that kind of commitment, like, I mean, that's a fucking moral commitment that is hard to relate to, but there are men now and women whose job it is to do that sort of thing, and they probably would and have done similar things, and so it's hard to put yourself in the shoes of someone who has to make that and not be like, nah, I'm not doing it. I'm not doing that. Court-martial be damned, you know?
That's what I mean. I talked about that one, but there are a couple of them, story about the guy in Russia during the Cold War who disobeyed orders and therefore effectively saved the world because it just turned out that they were going off a glitch in their system. Like
worst case scenario, right? You were wrong to disobey. You get back and America has been nuclear bombed by the Russians. The Russians win the war. You potentially, if there's an American army left, you are the Americans. Americans hate you because you could have done something. Like, even then, I'm like, yeah, but still better that you didn't, isn't it? Like, you have the moral high ground of not being the first one to use a nuclear. Do you know what I mean? I that's terrible. You couldn't go back and face any form of life if
I like that happens. Like your idea of existing in a like Fallout 3 style world, but with the moral high ground.
you're back. You were supposed to bomb Moscow, and if you had, it would have stopped America being defeated and like being an apocalyptic landscape. And there's about five army guys that are all their clothes are in tatters, and they're looking at you like, you fucking prick. First of all, you're out of the army. Second of all, look how many people are dead. You couldn't have stopped. Oh, for shame. Well, you're not getting a folded flag on your coffin, mate. Off you go into the no man's land, and you go get nuclear poison, mate, because you have let us all down. You prick. drop the bomb when you're told. Ah, you know, I don't know.
I didn't even nuke Megaton in Fallout 3. I couldn't do it.
Ah, good. This is the thing. It's a big ask to make anyone do that. But then, that's the idea. I can't get behind that mentality of soldiering. It's just...
Well, I mean, that's very hard thing, isn't it?
Yeah. It's at the most extreme in this film. Like, generally, doing what you're told, the greater good is the thing you're aiming for. You're protecting your country, the people you love, by even if you're doing stuff that harms people you like, you're doing it because the end results are for your country and your people.
Yeah, you're putting that in front of yourself and your own...
Yeah, and I can understand that. Sure. But it's insufferable in this film because you think, come on, guy, get the fucking picture, mate. Like, duh.
I think it's clearly only a mistake. That's because you know as the audience.
Yeah, that's true. The wife was probably like, oh, come on, the Russians haven't faked that, mate. At least call it into question. At least open the phone lines and talk to the fake communist president. Do you know what I mean? Like, have some more doubt than just ignoring your wife shouting at you, mate.
Well, that's what I mean. It's drilled into him. You don't listen to anyone.
And then you got him, like, the sadness of him having to, like, he knows what's happened. Like, the pilots that are trying to shoot him down, he's aware of his... Like, they're trying to succeed with the mission, and he comes up with genius ideas to stop the Russians getting him. Yeah. It's just fair play to this film.
Any other, like, movie scenario, he would be, like, the hero of the film.
Yeah.
But because of the situation, you're just like, no, fucking no.
And then it's exemplified by, like, secretly, the people in the control room are like, fucking well done us. If this was a legit attack, we'd have fucking smoked the Russians.
That's the other thing that is comes up in the scene where Dom DeLuise makes his big appearance. is when the Bogan tries to get two different
American military troops.
Yeah, to tell the Russians on the phone.
They kind of freeze up and won't do it, or can't do it. It's against instinct. We hate communists. Yeah, we can't help them.
Can't tell them
to
things.
To kill our boys.
Give them the advantage. Yeah, like they freeze up because they can't do it. And then, I can't remember Dom DeLuise's character's name, comes up and does it. And he looks fucking haunted and he sits down and all the guys around him are just staring at him.
Yeah.
Like, could you do it? But at the same time, well, we have to. Like... There's so much like complexity done in with so little throughout the film. Again, very similar to 12 Angry Men. A lot of it is just from like things they say and the way they say it, how they look when they do it.
And even the guy, you know, the guy who's in charge of the control room has to boss everyone into doing what the president says because he knows that's what they do. That we follow the president says something, you do it. It doesn't matter if it's killing our own guys. He understands the scenario. But at any point where someone faints, is angry, gets pulled, like they pull the colonel away because he's ranting and raving and saying how
breakdown.
We should attack them. It's all a lie. It's definitely the Russians looking at us. He kind of goes mad, and the guy's like, I understand him doing that. Like, he's totally like, anyone who has a breakdown, it's all cool because I feel like this is mental as well. And that's something I appreciated. And then on the phone, the Russians are like, our end is the same, mate. It's all horrible, mate. And that's what's really good about the film, is it isn't trying to be overly political. It's just dealing with ethics, war, morality, how technology is a bastard. You know, it's always on point for not being overly biased one way or the other. You know, I think that's good.
I think that's ultimately why the biggest thing I liked about it was that it isn't necessarily... I mean, you will get people who say it's... You know,
of course it is.
It's an agenda, it's anti-war or whatever, but...
I mean, really, would you say perhaps Fonda should be like, now that you have accidentally bombed Russia. It's all well and good to say it's fairer to bomb New York and not have a global war, but Morto may not have the good intentions of, you know, he's not doing it for the right reason. He wants to stop communism, but, well, let's... New York's really cool. Oh, do we have any important do we have any important documents there? No, it'll be all right. Still, though, it's New York. Fuck it. Let's attack the Russians. Come on. Like, you'd be tempted to be like, well, we weren't planning this, Russia, but now that we're committed, sorry. Yeah. What do you guys reckon? Would that be an option?
Well, I mean, that's what.
Should it have been an option in the film?
He presented it as an option.
But would it have been? I would have understood that decision as well, and I'd be like, Fonda, how could you?
It would have been a gamble, though. I mean, the bombing New York would have put an end to it, but just because Walter Matthau is saying they'll surrender doesn't mean they actually will surrender.
It'd be a massive heel turn on the Russians. He's gained their trust, then he goes, yeah, but now that I've made the deal, I don't like it. Sorry?
Hits him with a steel chair.
That's it. It would be it should be like, oh, Moscow, you thought I was going to bomb New York. That missile is coming for your other cities. Fuck you! Ah! See you in hell, commie fucks! This was a trick, but I've totally capitalised on it. Fonda out! It's utterly, like, turns on them.
It's...
After this film, Fonda, so he's bombed New York. First of all, do the press get to know about it? They get to know what the president decided. Because I'm imagining there's a lot of people going, fuck off, you bombed New York! Should have bombed the rest of Russia!
Like, what would the consequences be after this film? Because it ends and it doesn't, like, it just stops.
Like, the sequel you do, not safe. And then it's people dealing with, like, you've actually got, you know, nuclear weather affecting the whole globe.
Failsafe 2, fail safer.
Yeah. I don't know what you do. You just... It's still really bad. The scenario, like, maybe...
No, that's the thing.
Communism, like, and capitalism can get on, and Russia and America can see eye to eye and realise nuclear war is ridiculous, but...
No, it would probably just escalate more.
Yeah, it would cause further political factions. It would be terrible. There'd be, like, civil war in America and Russia. There'd be the whole world economy would be fucked. It's still bad. It's like, there's no... At that point, you go, let's just... Fuck you, Russia. You're the only ones getting hit by the bomb. It doesn't make sense to make it worse with bombs. Like, I don't know. Sorry, I'm needlessly protracting things by speculating on what maybe other scenario. Like, but that's what the film wants, in a way. It wants you to think about these big things.
It engages you potentially, like, may sit there and be on the side of a particular character, because no one's presented necessarily as an absolute villain.
I like the two guys that talk about London for a bit on the phone. They're like, "Oh, you were in London, were you? Oh, is it the translators or someone else?" Like,
it's the generals, and one of them can, like, the Russian can speak really good English because where he was posted in World War II.
Yeah, and they're like, "Oh, do you like London?" "Yeah, I did." "Oh, see you later, pal." "Yeah, bye, friend." Yeah. Like, oh,
yeah.
Turns out we can all get along after all.
Yeah, they both, like, understand. Like, how fucked up it all is at that point.
Anyway, now I think we've talked about the film in many different ways. Are there any other bits and bobs? Otherwise, I think we should just come to our usual metaphor and last thoughts bit, because it's, you know, we're in danger of slogging through it even longer, because there's still other bits that are worth talking about, but people should maybe check it out for themselves if they can start thinking about the issues any further.
Only little things that probably haven't got much relevance.
No, you can shout out.
But just things that I just have stuck in my mind. One of them being the most annoying opening credits ever, which don't let you see what's going on. Do you remember those? Nothing was happening. It was just Lieutenant Black kind of getting up out of bed and going to check his kids and then coming back. But the credits were so big and so central that you just can't see what the hell is going behind them.
I mean,
just a little thing like that.
But But then it was such a boring scene, it's kind of like, may as well crack on with it.
True. And then another thing that really annoyed me was, right at the beginning, there's a scene, like, I think it's the pilots, in like playing pool in the Arctic base, and they're just hitting balls. And it really annoyed me. I'm guessing it's just because the camera was in a certain position, and if the cue ball's not there and you still have to take a shot kind of thing, you just hit it. But then I noticed, like, it's always the same in movies. What I've always wondered, like, how to play pool? Because they seem to just hit balls around the table.
Well, you're either playing colours or
but
stripes.
But I just kind of figured it out. Yeah, but I just figured it out now that it's a filmic thing, because they just have to hit the ball where they're standing, no matter what ball it is, kind of thing.
Yeah, it's like people driving in films. It's like they just wiggle the wheel back and forth as if that's how cars work. Yeah. You're right, though. I feel like this film should... There's so many things in this film that make the last credit bit... It should have the song... If we could turn back time... And it should have like a montage of all the little things and all the big things that could be different.
Yeah, that'd be the perfect song. Maybe the TV remake did that.
They made a TV remake of this.
They did a live like teleplay of it with George Clooney, Richard Dreyfuss, a bunch of other people in like 2000.
Oh. Shit.
can't quite imagine. Oh, I don't know. I think this does it. You wouldn't want to do this. Is definitive. I get it. This is the one to watch. I can't see there being any.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing with 12 Angry Men. They like that was remade and. But no, I don't know if I think I've kind of thoroughly gone over most of what I had. I mean, it's very good, but it's very, very bleak. It's not an issue with the film, because that's obviously the intent, but it's not something that you can just sort of watch. Like 12 Angry Men, as heavy as it is, it's pretty watchable if you're, you know, okay with just like dialogue driven human drama. It's not, you know, it doesn't have, you know, a thing where millions of people die at the end of it. Yeah. It's just some angry men in a room.
So I think I've got a metaphor. You guys could either have yours ready or think about them, but I mean, this is a spoiler now for a video game, so sorry. You don't have to listen to this bit if you don't want, but I'm going to spoil a little bit Far Cry 5. But to me, it's like playing Far Cry 5, because that ends with two options. One, we're fucked. One, we're all fucked. And it's like, I want to play the game where I get to save the day. And this film is like, I want to watch the film where it doesn't all go... It's like, oh, it's so frustrating. You go through the whole journey, you're like, oh, for fuck's sake. Or, you know, you go, no! And like the dust, and it's such a fucky, oh, no. There's no playing the film again and having an alternate reality. It's always a fuck you. And that's... Far Cry does that. It's like, oh, that was a good little journey where I went on, but... Where's the load it up from the previous save game and try the alternate ending? It's like, oh, you fucked me again. What's the deal?
Maybe influenced an idea for me, because like it's similar to, you know, in a lot of like RPGs and stuff. You get like conversation trees where you pick certain options. And I've been playing fucking Witcher 3 for 100 years now, and that game has certain decisions you have to make within a very short space of time. Like, it gives you a little meter that's running out, and you have to make a critical decision out of two options. This film's all that. It's just that little meter going, oh no, should I say yes? Should I say no? Like, what do I help them? Should I leave them do it? No. And then like you make a decision, and then you're like, fuck. Yeah, and then you're like, wait, is all this stuff bad because of that? I don't know. Like, because I made four other decisions after this.
Yeah. But crucially, like, for my metaphor, anyway, I liked the game. A super fun game, Far Cry. I recommend it. It's not just about the endings. And this is film. It's not just about the ending. It's about the whole journey. It's still, like, so the game is good, the film is good, but it leaves you with the same bitter taste of, oh, come on. Are you kidding? Yeah. Which, you know... That's the point. And then your Witcher thing, it's like there's that mechanic is in lots of games, even in like wrestling games, where you pit dialogue responses. You're like, what the fuck, that was exactly the right, and now the meter's changed, and I can't, this is committed now, this is canon, my creator character's ruined as a baby.
Yes!
Yeah, anyway.
But, yeah, it's the, you wouldn't necessarily call it fun, but the engagement is the making of those decisions and then, like, how that influences future decisions that you make later on. That's what's happening here. It's that escalation of a choice then leads to another set of choices, which then leads to that, and then ultimately the, you know, the consequences at the end of the film. But it all stems from a fucking mistake.
Yeah.
Which is the fucking bastard right at the center of the film. It's nobody's fault, but it's everyone's fault.
Yeah. Bloody machine's fault, isn't it? Fucking, But like, what I think you said there, which was good, was it was all fine. I like a tagline should be fail-safe. Not exactly what you'd call fun, but it's entertaining. It's gripping. Yeah. It's not exactly fun, but It's whimsy and lols and
Well, I think it's something that anyone who likes Doctor Strangelove, it's worth watching this to see.
If you thought that was a light-hearted romp.
Oh, if you thought that was funny, just you fucking wait for Failsafe. But But it's
yee-hawing and waving your cowboy cap in this one.
As you ride it down all the way down. I think it was interesting for me to see a very similar story done in a very different way.
Yeah. Anthony, it's all on you. Before the timer goes off and we're all wiped off the earth. Go.
The word enjoy is not quite right, is it, Jamie? The film gripped me practically, as soon as it started. The action, it started, it had me till the end. I was gripped all the way through. It's a film that deals with big kind of political ideas, but makes them digestible enough for most people to understand what they're getting at.
Hmm.
It's not complicated, it's just heavy. Yeah.
Like, it feels that way, because, you have a kind of political professor kind of giving lectures and stuff, and yet I don't want to say it's dumbed down, but like it's just made digestible enough for everyone to understand, to give the film as much impact as it can. I feel there's a lot of similarities, like you said, between this and Lumet's earlier film 12 Angry Men, like a decade before, and I feel like he's really honed like his craft in the time, just the cinematography, like the color, bad word color for a black and white film, but you understand the lighting, the shade.
Yeah, it's one of those films that is a very good example of black and white films can look fantastic. Stop being a baby.
Yeah, I remember in. When I was in university, one of the lectures talked about how, like, black and white films are technically, adding colour made them worse. And I didn't quite get what they were trying to say for a while. But watching a lot of the films of Sidney Lumet, I kind of understand what they're saying.
Yeah, there was a fad a while ago. I think it was an American TV network that did it, where they would go through digitally colorize black and white films.
I got a Mad Max Fury Road connection. They did the black and white version of that as like a kind of artistic alternate version to make you change how you view it, perhaps.
I still haven't watched that version. Apparently, George Miller originally wanted to make it in black and white.
Mark Kermode thinks it made it better. But then he didn't love it instantly like everyone else should.
Mm-hmm.
Really? Did he not? Oh, well.
He was the usual sort of blockbuster pish. And then
off with that Kermode.
But he said he said on second watching Black and White, he thought it was like improved. So who
knows? It was originally supposed to be in black and white and with no dialogue, just sound and music. God.
The sound of we're not talking about that.
Yeah. I do, but no, we're not.
Anyway, right. Sorry, Anthony. We should let him finish.
Yeah. Just the only other thing I want to say is how aware I was of American kind of like Hollywood movie conventions, and then just how much it just says no, fuck you to all that. I can't really think of a metaphor for it. Like, it's a really good well-written pamphlet about how to survive a nuclear war.
Well, not one of the ones where you lie and cover your head, lie under your desk, and it'll all be fine. It's like a one that tells you actually how to get fresh water if you're in an area that isn't affected and things. I don't know.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's giving you, it's made all the information, you know, as accessible as possible, and it's all there. It's well written, and it's all concise. But at the end of the day, who the fuck wants to read how to survive a nuclear war?
I like how it would start like, so you've nuclear bombed New York and Moscow. What to do next?
Or so the sirens are going off, and you have 2 minutes.
Your wife has melted, and there's no more New York. What do like, you know?
It's the kind of thing you're only ever going to read once, and it's going to bum you out, kind of thing.
So it's a big old, well, it's a pretty hefty, depressing pamphlet that's coherent and makes you think.
Or a very compelling but catastrophic game of Monopoly with your family.
I take nuclear war over another game. Maybe not.
I would say, like, in terms of who should watch it, I would recommend it if you like character drama.
Or maybe morbid discussions of nuclear apocalypse.
But if you are going to watch it, plan your day so that you have something fun to do afterwards so that you quickly forget how the film ends.
Not to watch when you're having a Debbie Downer day. You're like, I think I'm a bit sad. I think I'll watch Failsafe. Cheer myself up.
Cheer myself
just
up.
Just sitting there thinking, yeah, my ex lived in New York, bitch.
Failsafe.
My shit mum lives in Moscow. Fucking die. It's cathartic,
Maybe watch Failsafe, then have a cup of tea and go to the zoo.
Cheer up, it's depressing as fuck, you're right. Thanks, Jamie. What next, eh? Last week's film was very light, so...
It's fine. I will go back to picking my usual choices.
Yay. Maybe.
To make things depressing and infuriating in a different way.
Yeah. Well, next time I think we're going to have some dancing, if Abby's not a blip on a radar that's disappeared into the sea. But anyway, whatever we do, join us again for a long chat about a thing. Usually films. Always films. It's always a spoiler-filled film conversation. Please come again. Thank you and goodbye. Say goodbye, guys.
Bye.
Please insert coin.
Wait, what?
I don't know. What happened at the end of the apocalypse there?
Please insert a coin.
The video game end? What was that about? Don't remember. Is it in a coin in the first place? Didn't ask to be born.
I wasn't expecting that last bit.
I didn't ask expecting to say born. It.